Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C2. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
I've never been much of a recreational walker. I spent 24 years raising children who weren't big on long walks either. A series of family dogs changed that a little, but our rescues were often mature in years, so walks tended to be shortish and slow.
Extract 1.
Riders got 5 miles at least of flat, sandy, safe beaches and bays and pubs, which make a wonderful walk, especially in winter time when the trippers have tripped away and the fun fair has gone to sleep. There are people who prefer looking at a blank sea, seeing nothing, water, water everywhere, feeling alone with nature. I like to see things, to spot things, imagine things, to see painted ships upon a painted ocean. That's how it looks if you stare at the picture out across the Solent from the Isle of Wight. There are so many ships of all shapes and sizes, poises and purposes, gleaming cruise liners, loads of yachts, of course, gliding from cows, but also stately tankers and smokestack coasters chugging up the Solent on the wild winter days.
Extract 2.
My favourite walk takes me on a gentle curve that brings me all the way down the lane and over the stream towards the woods before heading out and over the fields up onto the hill itself. There's a little stone bridge over the stream. Mullica Wood lies just beyond, described in the Huddersfield Chronicle of 1894 as an earthly paradise, its hidden entrance being suggestive of another, better Eden. A little stone stile marks the entrance. The final climb to the top is sharp. On windy days it's sometimes hard to stop oneself from being blown away.
Extract 3.
They say familiarity breeds contempt, but I've walked my kids to and from school for the last 7 years of my life, work permitting, and would happily do so every day until I died. It might get odd after a while, as my son's 60-year-old legs wither down from his equally perishing shorts, and my 57-year-old daughter stoops over the plastic basket of her bicycle with something approaching disgust in her eyes, but I'd be happy. And, as a parent, isn't that what's really important? There is nothing particularly attractive about the walk, just landmarks to tick off as we pass. a tube station inhaling its volunteers to the working day, and a tiny Italian cafe, which once proudly offered a Valentine's special of fish hearts in pink cream, and which now, perhaps unsurprisingly, is boarded up. Finally, as we pass a hauntingly Spartan pharmacy, we are engulfed by a benevolent cloud of hellos and good mornings, within which I fix both kids with a kiss that they generously endure, and turn and head back.
Extract 4.
To walk up Old Mount Road out of the village of Marsden is something of a vertical takeoff, so best done in winter when you can cool the body's engine by sucking cold air deep into the lungs. After only 5 minutes or so, the village has become a view, cupped in the head of the valley, collared by moorland, the massive empty mill at bank bottom rotting away towards the status of eyesore.
Extract 5.
I often set off on my daily walk, not knowing which way I'm going. I go where my wellies take me. I could decide to go across the field behind our cottage, down through the wood, into the marsh field to the river Torridge, where Tarka the Otter lived. His descendants still live there, but I despair of seeing one again. Duck will fly off, an egret maybe, or cormorant, a kingfisher if I'm lucky. But it's been raining streams, and it'll be muddy. I decide to walk up to the village. I walk like Beethoven, hands behind my back, leaning forward into the wind and rain. Symphonies I don't do, sadly. I'm deep into a story of the life of a drover's dog called Cobweb, returning home to Wales after driving the cattle to market in London.
Extract 6.
I grew up deep in rural West Tyrone and in a house that was perched kind of like the grand old Duke of York. And as a child, I often walked the not particularly special country road that looped around our hill, and I came to know every inch of road. And I'm long gone from that swarm of drumlins that I grew up among, but I still walk our road in my mind, choosing the season I want to be in. I sometimes choose the soft air of those weeks when calves, freshly separated from their mothers, are in the hayfield near the crossroads. And they're so desperate for touch, they'll take my whole hand into their mouths. I walk the road barefoot on high summer days, coming home black-souled and shamefaced, still expecting to be scolded for my dirty feet.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
I've never been much of a recreational walker. I spent 24 years raising children who weren't big on long walks either. A series of family dogs changed that a little, but our rescues were often mature in years, so walks tended to be shortish and slow.
Extract 1.
Riders got 5 miles at least of flat, sandy, safe beaches and bays and pubs, which make a wonderful walk, especially in winter time when the trippers have tripped away and the fun fair has gone to sleep. There are people who prefer looking at a blank sea, seeing nothing, water, water everywhere, feeling alone with nature. I like to see things, to spot things, imagine things, to see painted ships upon a painted ocean. That's how it looks if you stare at the picture out across the Solent from the Isle of Wight. There are so many ships of all shapes and sizes, poises and purposes, gleaming cruise liners, loads of yachts, of course, gliding from cows, but also stately tankers and smokestack coasters chugging up the Solent on the wild winter days.
Extract 2.
My favourite walk takes me on a gentle curve that brings me all the way down the lane and over the stream towards the woods before heading out and over the fields up onto the hill itself. There's a little stone bridge over the stream. Mullica Wood lies just beyond, described in the Huddersfield Chronicle of 1894 as an earthly paradise, its hidden entrance being suggestive of another, better Eden. A little stone stile marks the entrance. The final climb to the top is sharp. On windy days, it's sometimes hard to stop oneself from being blown away.
Extract 3.
They say familiarity breeds contempt, but I've walked my kids to and from school for the last 7 years of my life, work permitting, and would happily do so every day until I died. It might get odd after a while, as my son's 60-year-old legs wither down from his equally perishing shorts, and my 57-year-old daughter stoops over the plastic basket of her bicycle with something approaching disgust in her eyes, but I'd be happy. And, as a parent, isn't that what's really important? There is nothing particularly attractive about the walk, just landmarks to tick off as we pass. A tube station, inhaling its volunteers to the working day, and a tiny Italian cafe, which once proudly offered a Valentine's special of fish hearts in pink cream, and which now, perhaps unsurprisingly, is boarded up. Finally, as we pass a hauntingly Spartan pharmacy, we are engulfed by a benevolent cloud of hellos and good mornings, within which I fix both kids with a kiss that they generously endure, and turn and head back.
Extract 4.
To walk up Old Mount Road out of the village of Marsden is something of a vertical takeoff, so best done in winter when you can cool the body's engine by sucking cold air deep into the lungs. After only 5 minutes or so, the village has become a view. Cupped in the head of the valley, collared by moorland, the massive empty mill at bank bottom rotting away towards the status of eyesore.
Extract 5.
I often set off on my daily walk, not knowing which way I'm going. I go where my wellies take me. I could decide to go across the field behind our cottage, down through the wood, into the marsh field to the river Torridge, where Tarka the Otter lived. His descendants still live there, but I despair of seeing one again. Duck will fly off, an egret maybe, or cormorant, a kingfisher if I'm lucky. But it's been raining streams, and it'll be muddy. I decide to walk up to the village. I walk like Beethoven, hands behind my back, leaning forward into the wind and rain. Symphonies I don't do, sadly. I'm deep into a story of the life of a drover's dog called Cobweb, returning home to Wales after driving the cattle to market in London.
Extract 6.
I grew up deep in rural West Tyrone and in a house that was perched kind of like the grand old Duke of York. And as a child, I often walked the not particularly special country road that looped around our hill, and I came to know every inch of road. And I'm long gone from that swarm of drumlins that I grew up among, but I still walk our road in my mind, choosing the season I want to be in. I sometimes choose the soft air of those weeks when calves, freshly separated from their mothers, are in the high field near the crossroads. And they're so desperate for touch, they'll take my whole hand into their mouths. I walk the road barefoot on high summer days, coming home black-souled and shamefaced, still expecting to be scolded for my dirty feet.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Now we're going to turn to house prices. They continue to rise. The trend is unlikely to change anytime soon, and the lack of supply is continuing to be a factor. Ronan Lyons, Trinity College economist and author of the Daft.ie housing sales report, is on the line. Good morning, Ronan.
Good morning, Mary.
When you look across the last 12 months, what does the data tell you now about the increases, not just in the main urban centres, but also outside of the cities?
Yes, in fact, if anything, 2021 was the year where we saw the traditional urban-rural divide flip. For the last few years, we've been used to the urban centre seeing the biggest increases, but in 2021, it was the opposite. So while, say, Galway City and Dublin City saw increases of a couple of percent, so prices are still going up, but only slightly, in rural parts of the country, prices rose by between 10 and in some cases up to 20% over the course of the year. So that, I think, tells us not only that COVID had an impact, a positive impact on demand with, say, unexpected savings working their way into the housing system and a negative impact on supply in general, which we can come back to. But it also reshuffled demand. It made people look at the housing market in a different way, and it certainly boosted the demand in places, for example, like Leitrim, or indeed Galway County outside the city area, or Mayo, where prices are up by between 15% and 20% over the last 12 months.
Is there any sign at all, Ronan, of a levelling out of prices, or even a drop in prices in some areas?
So the increases in the last quarter of the year were smaller than earlier in the year. Now, that sometimes happens anyway. So there are seasonal things looking quarter to quarter. So typically we look year to year. The rate of increase over the course of 2021 was, as I call it in the commentary, stubbornly high. It was almost exactly the same as it was in 2020 and the average of the previous few years, and between 7.5% and 8% over the course of the year. Now, that is an increase far above the increase in general prices, even though there is a spike in wider inflation at the moment. The wider economy is seeing prices typically increase 1 or 2% year on year. So an increase of 7 or 8% is well above. And it tells us that we don't have the supply we need in the market for sale. And if you look at the numbers of properties available, that's one way of looking at the supply. In fact, it's really looking at supply and demand. It's the amount of properties available online at any particular point in time. And typically across the country, it's about half of what it was in 2018 or 2019, which, if if you think back, that wasn't a market that was flooded with supply. That was still a market where demand was stronger than supply. But things have got a lot worse over the last 2 years.
When will they get better? Just look ahead over the next couple of years and briefly tell us, where do we go from here?
Yeah, there are two elements to improving things. One is in relation to new supply, building new supply, and the government has been recognising this fact over the last year or so with a number of new plans. The question is to what extent that's entirely within our local control within Ireland. There are global problems with supply chains, and they're likely to feed through to higher costs. And the higher costs are the fewer homes get built because it's more expensive. You need a bigger income. And I think that's a broader point that the government needs to take on board, that construction costs are a key issue in resolving the problems in the housing system. The other part of the supply solution is more, I suppose, like a natural process within the market. It's the second-hand supply. And if you think to somebody who would have been in other circumstances without COVID, trading up over the last year or so, there was very little incentive for them to think about putting their home on the market, because if what home could they see? There were restrictions on getting out there and viewing other properties. So second-hand supply fell by quite a lot over the last year or so. That has started to turn, but that's a slow, natural process, and that I expect to improve over the course of 2022, assuming things don't get worse in terms of COVID.
Ronan Lyons, good to talk to you this morning. Thank you.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Now we're going to turn to house prices. They continue to rise. The trend is unlikely to change anytime soon, and the lack of supply is continuing to be a factor. Ronan Lyons, Trinity College economist and author of the Daft.ie housing sales report, is on the line. Good morning, Ronan.
Good morning, Mary.
When you look across the last 12 months, what does the data tell you now about the increases, not just in the main urban centres, but also outside of the cities?
Yes, in fact, if anything, 2021 was the year where we saw the traditional urban-rural divide flip. For the last few years, we've been used to the urban centre seeing the biggest increases, but in 2021, it was the opposite. So while, say, Galway City and Dublin City saw increases of a couple of percent, so prices are still going up, but only slightly, in rural parts of the country, prices rose by between 10 and in some cases up to 20% over the course of the year. So that, I think, tells us not only that COVID had an impact, a positive impact on demand, with say, unexpected savings working their way into the housing system, and a negative impact on supply in general, which we can come back to. But it also reshuffled demand. It made people look at the housing market in a different way, and it certainly boosted the demand in places, for example, like Leitrim, or indeed Galway County outside the city area, or Mayo, where prices are up by between 15% and 20% over the last 12 months.
Is there any sign at all, Ronan, of a levelling out of prices, or even a drop in prices in some areas?
So the increases in the last quarter of the year were smaller than earlier in the year. Now that sometimes happens anyway. So there are seasonal things looking quarter to quarter. So typically we look year to year. The rate of increase over the course of 2021 was, as I call it in the commentary, stubbornly high. It was almost exactly the same as it was in 2020 and the average of the previous few years, and between 7.5% and 8% over the course of the year. Now that is an increase far above the increase in general prices, even though there is a spike spike in wider inflation at the moment, the wider economy is seeing prices typically increase 1 or 2% year on year. So an increase of 7 or 8% is well above. And it tells us that we don't have the supply we need in the market for sale. And if you look at the numbers of properties available, that's one way of looking at the supply. In fact, it's really looking at supply and demand. It's the amount of properties available online at any particular point in time. And typically across the country, it's about half of what it was in 2018 or 2019, which if you think back, that wasn't a market that was flooded with supply. That was still a market where demand was stronger than supply. But things have got a lot worse over the last 2 years.
When will they get better? Just look ahead over the next couple of years and briefly tell us, where do we go from here?
Yeah, there are two elements to improving things. One is in relation to new supply, building new supply, and the government has been recognising this fact over the last year or so with a number of new plans. The question is to what extent that's entirely within our local control within Ireland. There are global problems with supply chains, and they're likely to feed through to higher costs. And the higher costs are the fewer homes get built because it's more expensive. You need a bigger income. And I think that's a broader point that the government needs to take on board, that construction costs are a key issue in resolving the problems in the housing system. The other part of the supply solution is more, I suppose, like a natural process within the market. It's the secondhand supply. And if you think to somebody who would have been in other circumstances without COVID trading up over the last year or so, there was very little incentive for them to think about putting their home on the market, because if what home could they see? There were restrictions on getting out there and viewing other properties. So secondhand supply fell by quite a lot over the last year or so. That has started to turn, but that's a slow natural process, and that I expect to improve over the course of 2022. All right. Assuming things don't get worse in terms of COVID.
Ronan Lyons, good to talk to you this morning. Thank you.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Carly, we have messages coming in on this. I saw two foxes in our hay barn yesterday morning. The hay barn is 50 metres from our house. And this listener wants to know, is it normal for them to come so close to our home?
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen videos of foxes that live under people's garden sheds in tiny little postage stamps of gardens, you know. So even in Trinity College in here, we have them living under outbuildings that are right beside residents. And we've kind of built them now a purpose-built fox den. And hopefully they're going to take up residence in that. It's right beside our new wildlife pond. But they're well used to living beside people, and it doesn't bother them at all.
Doesn't seem to. This one, here's a lovely story. We have a fox visiting our house every night for the last week. What joy it brings. Thanks to the Ukrainian boy, Alex, who's staying with us and spotted it. We live in the countryside and we feed it scraps of meat and bread, etc. And this listener wants to know, should we feed this fox all year round?
So there's two schools of thought on feeding foxes. I think some people say do it and some people say don't. I think the most practical thing to do is to, if you are to look after your local foxes, I don't see any harm in it, but just don't get them too dependent on you, if that makes sense. So you give them a little bit of food that replicates their own sort of natural diet, eggs, bits of meat. You can even feed them kibble, cat food, stuff like that, stuff that will replicate them, not sweets and chocolates and the good stuff we like, but that kind of stuff. And just feed them little and often, and that means they don't become completely dependent on you and they'll still engage in their wild behaviour.
Yeah, because they're expert hunters, aren't they, foxes?
Fantastic, unbelievable hunters. I mean, like the urban foxes around Dublin, it was very interesting during lockdown. They completely switched back into being hunters because there was nothing to scavenge around during those months when people weren't in the city centre. And they completely switched overnight and just started killing all the pigeons that were around. It was incredible to watch from a naturalist point of view.
Mm-hmm. Some of them, I said I saw the fox scratching himself, but some of them look a bit mangy where the fur is missing. Is the policy not to intervene if you see that?
Generally, yeah, but we've intervened in here in the college to save some of our foxes that have had mange. And that's, you know, it's awful to see any animal suffer. And with a lot of the wildlife rescue groups, they'll intervene if you see a bad case, because mange in a fox, it's a really horrible end if they get a severe case, because it just really destroys them. So, you don't see any animals suffer.
Colly, on another matter, Caroline O'Doherty in the Irish Independent today tells us that the Department of Agriculture wants us to eat more venison, which is part of a plan to curb the number of deer in the countryside. Other people suggesting a cull. What do you make of that?
It sounds counterproductive from a love of nature point of view, but it really is important to get the deer numbers under control. We have no natural predators in Ireland. We have no wolves. We have no big cats going around keeping their numbers in check. If we want our native forests to start to recover or to increase broadleaf cover, we need to control the deer numbers, because once deer or sheep are free roaming on land, you don't get that natural progression from seed into adult tree that you would in a wild forest. They just munch anything that's on the ground that's below their head height, and it really is devastating for, you know, regrowth and rejuvenation in our woodlands that should be happening.
We heard we had a chat here on the program about culling deer in the past, and we heard that it doesn't work because if you take out the head deer, then there's no control in the group and the breeding actually increases.
Yeah. Again, there's a lot of arguments between naturalists as to what works and what doesn't. There's a lot of suggestions of even, you know, feeding female deers contraceptives that will kind of control the numbers of breeding. I think from a practical point of view, though, if you are to just consistently take out a certain number of deer every year, year upon year, for my mind, I think it's a very practical way, along with other measures such as fencing off areas to keep the deer out, to let natural regeneration happen. I think it is important to start considering these measures.
Colly, thanks very much for talking to us. Colly Ennis there from the Department of Zoology in Trinity College, Dublin.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Collie, we have messages coming in on this. I saw two foxes in our hay barn yesterday morning. The hay barn is 50 metres from our house. And this listener wants to know, is it normal for them to come so close to our home?
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen videos of foxes that live under people's garden sheds in tiny little postage stamps of gardens, you know. So even in Trinity College in here, we have them living under outbuildings that are right beside residents. And we've kind of built them now a purpose-built fox den. And hopefully they're going to take up residence in that. It's right beside our new wildlife pond. But they're well used to living beside people, and it doesn't bother them at all.
Doesn't seem to. This one, here's a lovely story. We have a fox visiting our house every night for the last week. What joy it brings. Thanks to the Ukrainian boy, Alex, who's staying with us and spotted it. We live in the countryside and we feed it scraps of meat and bread, etc. And this listener wants to know, should we feed this fox all year round?
So there's two schools of thought on feeding foxes. I think some people say do it and some people say don't. I think the most practical thing to do is to, if you are to look after your local foxes, I don't see any harm in it, but just don't get them too dependent on you, if that makes sense. So you give them a little bit of food that replicates their own sort of natural diet, eggs, bits of meat. You can even feed them kibble, calf food, stuff like that, stuff that will replicate them, not sweets and chocolates and the good stuff we like, but that kind of stuff. And just feed them little and often, and that means they don't become completely dependent on you and they'll still engage in their wild behaviour.
Yeah, because they're expert hunters, aren't they, foxes?
Fantastic, unbelievable hunters. I mean, like the urban foxes around Dublin, it was very interesting during lockdown. They completely switched back into being hunters because there was nothing to scavenge around during those months when people weren't in the city centre. And they completely switched overnight and just started killing all the pigeons that were around. It was incredible to watch from a naturalist point of view.
Mm-hmm. Some of them, I said I saw the fox scratching himself, but some of them look a bit mangy where the fur is missing. Is the policy not to intervene if you see that?
Generally, yeah, but we've intervened in here in the college to save some of our foxes that have had mange. And that's, you know, it's awful to see any animals suffer. And with a lot of the wildlife rescue groups, they'll intervene if you see a bad case, because mange in a fox, it's a really horrible end if they get a severe case, because it just really destroys them. So, you don't want to see any animals suffer.
Collie, on another matter, Caroline O'Doherty in the Irish Independent today tells us that the Department of Agriculture wants us to eat more venison, which is part of a plan to curb the number of deer in the countryside. Other people suggesting a cull. What do you make of that?
It sounds counterproductive from a love of nature point of view, but it really is important to get the deer numbers under control. We have no natural predators in Ireland. We have no wolves. We have no big cats going around keeping their numbers in check. If we want our native forests to start to recover or to increase broadleaf cover, we need to control the deer numbers, because once deer or sheep are free roaming on land, you don't get that natural progression from seed into adult tree that you would in a wild forest. They just munch anything that's on the ground that's below their head height, and it really is devastating for, you know, regrowth and rejuvenation in our woodlands that should be happening.
We heard we had a chat here on the programme about culling deer in the past, and we heard that it doesn't work because if you take out the head deer, then there's no control in the group and the breeding actually increases.
Yeah. Again, there's a lot of arguments between naturalists as to what works and what doesn't. There's a lot of suggestions of even, you know, feeding female deers contraceptives that will kind of control the numbers of breeding. I think from a practical point of view, though, if you are to just consistently take out a certain number of deer every year, year upon year, for my mind, I think it's a very practical way, along with other measures such as fencing off areas to keep the deer out, to let natural regeneration happen. I think it is important to start considering these measures.
Collie, thanks very much for talking to us. Collie Ennis there from the Department of Zoology in Trinity College, Dublin.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.